Well, let's begin with a little review. Of course, we know that the children of Israel had been in captivity for 70 years, and God had warned them what happened if they had disobeyed. And of course, they did. They got off into idolatry, and God deemed that they owed a total of 70 years for not keeping the sabbatical year of rest for the land. So God collected, and the land got 70 years of rest. Of course, we know that just as Isaiah had prophesied about 120 years ahead of time, that a global king named Cyrus let the Jews return to their homeland. Of course, this was in 536, as we have studied before. And the disappointing thing was that only about 50,000 of the Jews that were off in Babylon decided to return to the promised land. Most of them had adapted quite well to life outside of Israel. They were comfortable now in Babylon and treated well, so they had no reason. Business was good. Why return to the land that God had promised our forefathers? Of course, Zerubbabel was in the lineage of David, but he was not a king. He was a governor appointed by Cyrus under the authority of the Medo-Persian Empire. And of course, Joshua was the high priest that returned with him. When they got back to Jerusalem, they immediately rebuilt the altar and reinstituted the sacrificial system with the Levitical priesthood, and they laid the cornerstone to rebuild the temple. And of course, things got delayed. The Samaritans led in a political process, delaying the construction. And of course, the work wound up being stopped for a total of about 14 years. That's when we see Haggai and Zechariah, two contemporaries, called by God to go and charge the people to get back to work. Haggai reproved the people for their failure to rebuild the temple, also warned them about sin in their life as they were beginning to repeat the same sins that their forefathers had done, which caused them to be judged in the first place. And then Zechariah encouraged them that God was going to keep every promise that he made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, including those about the kingdom age, where the kingdom of Israel would be the number one country on planet Earth, and the King of Kings, the Messiah, would rule and reign from the throne of David in Jerusalem. Of course, these men's ministries laid over the top of each other with month 3 and 4 interlocking. And then after that, we don't hear from Haggai again after a very short 4-month ministry. But Zechariah, we hear some extensively. We know that 19 months after this first message, he had a bad night's sleep. He actually had 10 visions in one night, but all of these visions had the same purpose. They were confirming that God was going to keep his promises made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They were confirming that Israel would, in fact, be the global empire, that the kingdom of heaven would rule on planet Earth, and that God's Messiah would rule from Jerusalem. Of course, those visions were as such. We had the angel of the Lord taking note of the state of the world. God was not happy. The Gentiles were perfectly thrilled that there was no Israel and that Jerusalem was no longer a power player. Then we see, and this is the point I want to focus on, because tonight's lesson is going to come out of Vision 2, the four horns and the four smiths. Of course, these are the Gentile powers that ruled over Jerusalem. And then each power itself would face punishment from God. Then we see the fourth vision, city planning of the future, and how Jerusalem would have a population far larger than it had ever seen, and the city perimeter would be far larger than they had ever seen. Then we see the calling and cleansing of Joshua, the high priest, as Satan was making accusation, and Joshua was actually filthy, but the Lord provided a change of raiment. Of course, that was symbolic of God's forgiveness for Israel. Then we see the two olive trees. Again, symbolic, I believe, not just of Zerubbabel and Joshua, but also the two witnesses that we'll see in the book of Revelation. Then we see the flying Ten Commandments, a large scroll the size of the holy place that hovered over the planet. And, of course, this was a scroll of God's judgment. I think it's indicative of what's coming in the tribulation. Then we see wickedness carried away to Babylon in that basket. And then we see the four horsemen and the four chariots. Again, we are reintroduced to these particular horsemen later on in Revelation chapter 6. Then we saw a delegation being sent from Babylon, bringing a love offering to the construction project. And Zechariah was commanded to take the gold and silver and make a couple of crowns. Again, the gold representing the royalty of the throne, and silver representing redemption price of the priesthood. And these crowns were both placed symbolically on Joshua's head. And again, this was a presentation that the future, there would be a future priest after the order of Melchizedek, which would not only be a priest, but also king, and would rule. And of course, this is a picture of the Messiah. Also in this chapter, we see the Messiah prophesied as being the seed of the woman, or seed of man, a human being. Then, of course, our last lesson, we saw the delegation from Bethel that came down to Jerusalem. Since they were reconstructing the temple, was it still necessary to go through the annual mourning of Tisha B'Av, where they mourned for the destruction of the temple? Well, now that the temple is being rebuilt, was it necessary that they go through the motions? And of course, God chastised them, saying that you're not keeping this holiday unto me. You're keeping it because you feel sorry for yourselves. Now, remember the situation. We see Zerubbabel had returned after being in captivity for 70 years. We know in 445, actually about 60 years after where we are this evening, that Nehemiah, who was the cupbearer to the king, would have this passion laid upon his heart to go back and rebuild the streets of the city and the walls of Jerusalem. And he would, in fact, do that. That is a significant date when you look at Daniel chapter 9 and the 70 weeks of Daniel. Now, we know there was the promise of the kingdom. This goes all the way back to Abraham. Of course, it's reaffirmed at Mount Sinai, reaffirmed in Deuteronomy at the second giving of the law. And we know what promises have already been made. This is just a sampling. We know that about 60 years prior, I take that back about, 606? Yeah, about 60 years prior, that Jeremiah had this vision that Israel would experience a time of tribulation, the 7 years of Jacob's trouble, leading to the reestablishment of the kingdom. We know that about the same time frame, Daniel had a vision, the 70 weeks of judgment with a week yet to come that were determined upon Daniel's people, that would be the Israelites, and Daniel's holy city, that would be Jerusalem. We know that Daniel also said, when giving the vision of Nebuchadnezzar's dream of these empires that would rule over Jerusalem during this age of Gentile domination, that in the days of that last empire, that last global coalition, the 10 kings, of course I make reference to, Dan makes reference to, the World Economic Forum, they very well could be the fulfillment of that prophecy. Maybe not. However, everything seems to be lining up, and they certainly are candidates. But in the days of those kings, though the God of heaven set up a literal kingdom which shall never be destroyed, that being on planet Earth. And of course, Micah. We're about 530 here. This is almost 200 years before the time of Zechariah. The prophet Micah was given this vision. Isaiah was also given almost verbatim the same revelation that's recorded in Isaiah chapter 4, and that would have been about 100 years after. But it says this, "And many nations, Gentile nations, shall come and say, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths, for the law shall go forth of Zion." Again, Jerusalem will be the capital of the world. The law will come forth out of Jerusalem, and not just the Jews, but the Gentiles will come and worship and walk in his paths. And the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. "And the Messiah shall judge among many people." Again, not just Israel. This is global. "And rebuke strong nations that are afar off. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. But they shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree." That is where we get the idea of the pursuit of happiness and the Declaration of Independence. Every man being able to enjoy all the blessings that God has in store for him according to his will, even his own vine and his own fig tree, signs of plenty. "And none shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts hath spoken it." So we know that this is coming, and the Jews were looking for them. Now they were back in the land. Now that they were back to rebuilding the temple, they were looking for the Messiah. Well, how were they going to recognize the Messiah? Well, that's where Zechariah gives us some things to think about, and quite frankly, has caused a lot of confusion to the Jewish people ever since. We know that in Zechariah 9:9, which we'll see tonight, They would recognize the Messiah because he'd come humbly riding on a colt of a foal of a donkey over the top of the Mount of Olives into Jerusalem, bringing salvation. But then we also see in Zechariah 14 that the king shows up at a time of global war and will set foot on the Mount of Olives and destroy the enemies of Israel. And there will literally, as you hear me say before, be hell to pay by the Messiah at that point in time. Well, obviously, those are two very different occurrences. And the Jews have had a hard time figuring that out. We'll allude to that here in a moment with something that Peter said. Now, we now know, looking back, that that's where the church age fits in. Between the first coming and the second coming, we have this period of time that we find ourselves now. By the way, Jesus said when he was giving his message on the mystery, previously unrevealed truths and parables of the kingdom of heaven, that these mysteries were hidden, held secret from the foundation of the world. In other words, the Old Testament prophets didn't write about the period of time that we now call the church age. We know that Paul, when writing to the church of Ephesus about this church age, also called this period a mystery, which in other ages, by the way, how old was, where, when was Paul writing this? Approximately 60 AD. So the only Bible that they had up until that point of time would have been what we call the Old Testament. Paul said in other ages, this revelation, this mystery was not made known unto to men. But it is now revealed unto the holy apostles and prophets by the Spirit that the Gentiles should be fellow heirs and of the same body and partakers of his promise in Christ by the good news. And goes on and says again, which from the beginning of the world hath been hid in God. This idea of both Jew and Gentile, one body, whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved, was not visible in the Old Testament. Clarence Larkin was a famous Bible teacher. I believe he's an engineer by trade, because in his some of his works, he gives these very detailed graphic depictions of what we read about in Scripture. And he came up with this phrase called the mountain peaks of prophecy. And he pointed out that when the Old Testament prophet was looking off into the future, he could see Christ's first coming, and he could see Christ's second coming. By the way, Christ, Christos in the Greek, same word as Messiah, king, prince, in the Hebrew. What they could not see is in between this valley that we call the church age. Again, Clarence Larkin said the prophets did not see this. I showed you a moment ago. Jesus said that they didn't see it. Paul said that they didn't see it. So now we are looking at this judgment that's going to come upon the Gentiles. We first saw this in Zechariah chapter 1. We talked about the four horns and then the four blacksmiths. Tonight's lesson, Zechariah 9, which by the way, Zechariah 9:9 is in Zechariah 9. That'll sink in on your way home, which is why I gave this detailed backdrop, because that's very significant to us, the first coming of Christ. But it lays in this period that gives some details of God's coming judgment on some of the Gentile oppressors. So beginning in verse 1 of Zechariah 9, the burden of the word of the Lord in the land of Hadrach. Word burden, masa in the Hebrew. It means a heavy thing, a weighty thing, hence to be weighed down with this or have this rest upon you. This burden, this judgment of the Lord in the land of Hadrach. Now, Hadrach is not mentioned anywhere. A few other historical documents reference it. We can kind of pinpoint it by looking at the cities that this geographical area encompasses. We know that it's talking about Tyre and Sidon and Damascus because it's mentioned specifically in verse 1 and verse 2. But also notice that even though we are going to be focusing on Christ's first coming, Zechariah 9:9, ultimately this is global in impact and focuses on Christ's second coming. The eyes of the man, as of all the tribes of Israel, shall be toward the Lord. So the future of all the Gentile nations, as I just showed you a moment ago, what Micah had written and what Isaiah had written, during the millennial reign, all the nations of the world will worship in Jerusalem and will worship the Lord. So we see this is a global scope, which will be the age of the Messiah in its finality, is what's being referenced in verse 1. Now, we're going to see that Alexander the Great is going to come down into this area. And I believe that chapter 9 deals with, at least the first 8 verses, deals with Alexander's judgment on these particular perennial adversaries of Israel. We'll see that he will come down and lay siege at Tyre. We see that he will proceed down into Philistia and then on into Egypt. And we'll see that on his way back to the Far East is when he is prepared to lay siege to Jerusalem, but God changes his mind, and we'll learn about that here in just a moment. Verse 2, "And Hamath also shall border thereby Tyre and Sidon, though they be very wise." In other words, Tyre was very proud of itself. Tyre thought that it was quite clever. And Tyre, this city in Phoenicia, did build herself a stronghold, a fortress, and accumulated great wealth, heaped up silver as the dust, and fine gold as the mire of the streets. Behold, the Lord, even though they have built a fortress, even though they have amassed great wealth for their security, the Lord will cast her out. He will smite her power in the sea, and she will be devoured with fire. Now, it's interesting how specific this was fulfilled. It's also interesting to recognize that these prophecies were written before the Greek Septuagint was written, before many of these judgments actually came about. There will be skeptics that try to say this was written after the fact. We have absolute concrete evidence that this was a prophecy given by God to Zechariah hundreds of years before it actually took place. Now, Tyre was a unique city. It considered itself impregnable. It actually consisted of two parts. Part of the city was actually on the coast. It actually laid up right next to the Mediterranean Sea. Then the other half of the city was actually on an island a little less than a half a mile out in the Mediterranean. They had a 150-foot tall wall around the island city. Again, it was considered impregnable. They could be refed by ship. They had amassed great wealth there. Literally, they could hold off a siege of almost any duration. As a matter of fact, the Assyrians laid siege to the city when Shalmaneser was their king for 5 years and was unsuccessful in capturing it. Nebuchadnezzar, when he was leading the Babylonians, when they conquered Jerusalem, Nebuchadnezzar, even the brilliant military mind that he was, laid siege to Tyre for 13 years and eventually gave up unsuccessful. But Alexander the Great, this brilliant young mind that drank himself to death and was dead by the age of 33 because there were no more worlds for him to conquer, Alexander surveyed the situation, laid siege, and conquered it in 7 months. And what he did was he took the rubble from the destroyed city on the coast and built a causeway out to the island. Then, with their armaments of war, laid siege at the wall, the 150-foot-tall wall, and conquered the city of Tyre in 7 months, and then burned the city and leveled it, so he fulfilled every prophecy that was made here to Zechariah and through Zechariah. But Alexander didn't just stop there. Actually, that was a sign of what was to come to the other enemies, traditional enemies of Israel, down in Philistia. And these are some of the cities of Philistia. Ashkelon shall see what happens to Tyre and be very afraid. Gaza shall see it and be very sorrowful. And Ekron, for her expectation, shall be ashamed. In other words, Ekron was expecting that Tyre would be able to successfully resist and defeat Alexander. However, Ekron was very disappointed that that didn't happen. And the king shall perish from Gaza, and Ashkelon shall not be inhabited. And a bastard shall dwell in Ashdod. And what that means is that the inhabitants of Philistia will be transplanted elsewhere or killed, and others will be brought in to basically change the makeup of the people that dwell there. And I will take away his blood out of his mouth and his abominations. Whenever you read the word abomination in the Old Testament, recognize that it revolves predominantly around idol worship. Even the sexual immorality that's described as abomination usually revolved around the profane, illicit idol worship. and his abominations from between his teeth, this being the sacrifices, many of them eaten alive. But he that remaineth, even he shall be for our God. So there will be a remnant that survives all this, and when the day is done, even they, because all the inhabitants of the world, when the time the Messiah establishes his throne in Jerusalem, those that survive the tribulation, 100% of the occupants on planet Earth will be followers of the Messiah and the one true God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And I will encamp about mine house because of the army. Now, this is interesting. This siege that's coming down, Alexander the Great, conquers Tyre and Sidon, goes down in Philistia, eventually goes on into Egypt. But Jerusalem will be passed by, both coming and going, notice, because of him that passeth by and because of him that returneth. And no oppressor shall pass through them anymore, for now I have seen with mine eyes. Now, there's a historian that took the Roman name Flavius. His Jewish name was Josephus. He was actually a Jewish general during the rebellion against Rome in about 64 A.D., leading up through when Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 A.D. But Josephus was a military commander of the Jews in the northern area of Samaria. When he was captured, he was a turncoat. I mean, he begged for mercy. He promised to cooperate with the Romans. He lost his courage. He basically became a go-between, negotiating with the Jews in Jerusalem and even beyond. He also was valuable to us in that he wrote an in-detailed history of the Jewish people going all the way back to Adam. And it's from Josephus' Antiquities of the Jews, that's their history, that we get much of what I'm going to describe to you now. Again, Alexander had laid siege to Tyre, and at the time asked Jerusalem to help replenish his supplies. Now remember, the Jews had been freed by the Medo-Persians, and as such, they were still paying tribute to Medo-Persia and were still loyal politically to Medo-Persia. So when Alexander the Great, this young upstart from Greece, came through and asked for assistance, Janius, the high priest, declined because of his loyalty to the Medes and the Persians. Well, obviously, Alexander the Great was furious. The records show so. And he was very outspoken as what he was going to do to that high priest and to the city of Jerusalem once he got to it. However, he had to tend to what was at hand. He finished his conquest of Tyre. He went on down into Philistia, went on down into Egypt, and he was continuing his march, coming back to Jerusalem, heading to the east. Remember, he conquered the far east as well. And as he was approaching Jerusalem, the high priest of Jerusalem was obviously very concerned because he knew how ticked off he had made Alexander the Great. So they had a day of offerings in Jerusalem, and they cried out to the Lord for direction and for intervention. And this is what Josephus records, as is recorded in the annals of Jewish history. And when he understood that he was not far off, in other words, when Janius the high priest understood that Alexander the Great was making a beeline for the city of Jerusalem, he went out in procession with the priests and a multitude of the citizens of Jerusalem. The procession was venerable, in the manner of it different from that of other nations. And when the Phoenicians and the Chaldeans that followed Alexander thought they would have liberty to plunder Jerusalem and torment the high priest unto death, that's what Alexander had said was going to happen once they got to Jerusalem because he was so angry when they denied his request for assistance. They were all shocked, these that were now part of Alexander's army. They were greatly displeased that the king, being Alexander, had changed his mind and reversed course. For Alexander, when he saw the multitude at a distance, the high priests all in white garments, while the priests stood clothed in fine linen, the high priest in purple and scarlet clothing with his golden mitre on his head, having the golden plate whereon the name of God was engraved, he approached by himself and adored that name. Can you imagine Alexander showing reverence to the high priest and first saluted the high priest? The Jews also did all together with one voice salute Alexander, and they encompassed him about. And whereupon the kings of Syria and the rest were surprised at what Alexander had done, had supposed that he had lost his mind. However, one of Alexander's assistants went up to him alone and asked him how this all came to pass. How in the world you, Alexander the Great, the King of Kings at this point in time, would bow down to the high priest of the Jews? He said, I did not adore the high priest, but the God who hath honored him with his high priesthood. Now this is what Alexander said. I saw this very person in a dream. I saw this exact situation before I ever left Macedonia and came to Asia. I saw this very thing happen when I was considering with myself how I might obtain the dominion of Asia, that being Turkey and Babylon, and this, what was described as Asia, this dream exhorted me to make no delay, but boldly to pass over the sea from Europe to Asia, that he would conduct my army and would give me dominion over the Persians. Whence it is that having seen no other in that habit, and now seeing this person in it. In other words, I had this vision years ago. I remember it distinctly. And now I'm living it. I remember that vision and the exhortation which I had in my dream. I believe that I bring this army under the divine conduct and shall therewith conquer Darius and destroy the power of the Persians, and that all things will succeed according to what is in my own mind. Then, records show, they entered the city of Jerusalem and worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the temple. Now, there's another Jewish tradition that goes along with this, that the high priest actually showed him the scroll of Daniel and showed him where Daniel had talked about him specifically and what he would accomplish. And that is what moved him on in to do what he did in the temple complex. So, remember, we've already looked at this, but the Greeks came down, conquered Tyre and Sidon, and then went down into Philistia, went down into Egypt. Basically, this was where the wealth was. Then from this point, went back north. That's when he approached Jerusalem, had the interaction that we just read about in Flavius Josephus, and then went on up and progressed towards Asia. Now, why is that important? Why is that stuck here just before the famous verse 9 of chapter 9? Well, this judgment was going to happen. The judgment of the Gentiles was going to happen. Zechariah had first hinted at it in the first chapter. And this King of Kings would pass through Jerusalem. However, this was a reminder that this was not their king. Their king was still coming. How would they recognize him? Verse 9, rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming unto you. He is just, having salvation, humbly riding upon a donkey and upon a colt, the foal of a donkey. Now, a donkey was a sign of peace for a king. A king would ride a charger at a time of war. Oddly enough, the donkeys, because of their durability and other things, quite frankly, they weren't really designed for warfare. Riding on a donkey was not a sign of poverty, but it was a sign of a king's peace. And of course, remember in Jesus' 3 years on planet Earth, there were many times where the Jews came to him wanting to make him the king. One I thought about was in John chapter 6. After he had fed the 5,000. You remember the people were so pleased to have a good meal that they were going to take him by force and make him a king. And Jesus escaped from them. Now why? Well, let me tell you why. Because God told them how they would recognize their king. It's not because somebody showed up and fed you lunch. You're going to recognize your king in this fashion. And then, as we are coming into the Passion Week, over the next couple of weeks, we'll be talking about this next Wednesday night. We're talking about it a week from Tuesday in our Lord's Supper service. But Jesus went to great... He made sure that he fulfilled this prophecy specifically, which was talked about in Matthew. Why? Because Jesus was wanting to make sure that nobody missed the message. He was, in fact, this promised king, arriving just as Zechariah was told he would arrive. Now, let's cross-reference this with another passage of Scripture. Of course, Daniel was given some details of this final 7 years of judgment that's coming upon Israel and planet Earth. And of course, there's an interesting date that's given in verse 25. As far as when this period of time would take place, Daniel was told by the angel, "Know therefore and understand that from the time you get the command to go forth to restore and build Jerusalem." Now, that's very specific. That wasn't Zerubbabel's return. That wasn't the revival of the priesthood that was talked about in, I'll think about it in a minute. What it was, this was very clearly Nehemiah, when Nehemiah was burdened as the cupbearer to the king to go back and rebuild the walls of the city and streets. Until, from the time that command is given to rebuild the city of Jerusalem and the streets, until Messiah the Prince shall be a total of 69 times 7 years, or 483 years. Now, there was a famous biblical scholar that worked for Scotland Yard back in the 1800s named Sir Robert Anderson. He wrote many great books. One is this study called The Coming Prince. And Robert Anderson is the one that's credited with doing this research in this math. But if you take that 483 years and multiply it times 360, which was the number of days in a Jewish prophetic year, you have a total of 173,880 days. Sir Robert Anderson went back and actually found the date that Nehemiah received permission to go and begin his expedition to rebuild Jerusalem. And if you began at that date that he was given the orders from the king, and you counted 173,880 days to the day, was the 10th of Nisan in year 32 AD, when this Jesus of Nazareth came riding into Jerusalem on the colt, the foal of a donkey, just as Zechariah 9:9 had foretold. When you read in the Hallel Psalms, and it says, "This is the day that the Lord hath made, and you will rejoice and be glad in it." Now, we apply that to any day. We will say that frequently. Say, "Hey, this is the day the Lord has made." And by application, there is some truth to that. However, in the Hallel Psalms, it was specifically referring to this day, the day when your king comes riding into Jerusalem. It's amazing that they missed it. And that's why, you know, Jesus told the Pharisees, as they said, "Don't you know what your disciples are doing here?" Hey, the point is, they were declaring that he was the Messiah. And Jesus said, if they held their tongues, then it would force the rocks to cry out and testify on my behalf. Now, notice that Daniel goes on and says that after this period of time, the Messiah would be cut off or sacrificed. And of course, we know that's exactly what did happen. 173,880 days on the 10th of the month Nisan, the Messiah came riding into Jerusalem, fulfilling Zechariah 9:9. And then 4 days later, on the 14th of Nisan, in the afternoon, he bowed his head and dismissed his spirit. Now, again, they're looking for the coming king. There are these two advents which cause great confusion even to our day now. If you were to read Jewish commentaries and you read over in Zechariah 9, they will make reference to this couldn't have been the guy that was allegedly the Messiah 2,000 years ago because he didn't establish a global kingdom. There isn't peace on earth. Well, that's coming. That's this second coming, which is hence where we get the name, the second coming. And of course, the Old Testament prophets struggled with this. Notice Peter makes reference to this in his first epistle. He says, beginning in verse 10, "Of which salvation the prophets have inquired and searched diligently, who prophesied of the grace that should come unto you, searching what or what manner of time the Spirit of Christ which was in them did signify, when it testified beforehand of the sufferings of Christ," Isaiah 53, Daniel 9:26, Psalm 22, "and the glory that should follow him," Isaiah 4, Micah 2, all the promises of the age of the Messiah. So you got the sufferings of Christ and the glory that should follow him. Some Jews, even to this day, theorize that there must be two Messiahs, the Messiah the suffering Messiah after the order of Joseph that was sold by his brothers into bondage in Egypt, and the Messiah of the lineage of David, who shall rule and reign in power and glory. But again, as we are seeing here, and as we know, there's not two Messiahs, there's one Messiah that's making two trips. Zechariah 9:9, and then in Zechariah 14. Now, right after 9:9, we see a millennial reference, that I shall cut off the chariot from Ephraim, and the horse from Jerusalem, and the battle bow shall be cut off. There's going to be peace on earth. The Messiah, the King, shall speak peace unto the heathen. That's Goyim, Gentiles. And his dominion shall not be from the Mediterranean to the Jordan. It will be from sea even to sea, from the river even unto the ends of the earth. So you see, this is global in scope. This is the age of the Messiah, or is what we call the millennial reign of Christ. Now, verse 10 follows neatly after verse 9, but I'm going to show you that there are many instances where there is a parenthetical insert of this period of time, which Jesus said was kept secret in the Old Testament, which Paul also confirmed was kept secret in the Old Testament. Again, remember when Jesus returned to his hometown of Nazareth and visited the synagogue that he grew up in, and being a traveling rabbi with much discussion about him as being the possible Messiah, he was given the honor of the scripture reading and delivering the message that day. Of course, he would have stood up at the pulpit to read from the scroll of Isaiah, and then he would have sat down to teach. But he read from Isaiah 61, said, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because the Lord hath anointed me to preach good tidings unto the meek. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to them that are bound, to proclaim now is the time to accept the Lord." Now Luke tells us that at this point in mid-sentence, just before the reference to the tribulation, the day of vengeance of our God, and the millennium to comfort all that mourn, to appoint unto them that mourn in Zion, to give unto them beauty in place of their ashes, the oil of joy instead of mourning, the garment of praise in place of the spirit of heaviness, that they might be called the trees of righteousness that the Lord has planted, that he might be glorified. In other words, every promise he made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, he's going to keep. Not because the Jews deserve it, but because he's God and he made the promise. "And they shall build the old wastes, and they shall raise up the former desolations, and they shall repair the waste cities and the desolations of many generations." It's amazing to go to Israel today and to visit these cities that sit on the ruins of the ancient city that carry the name that they had in the times of Scripture. This is being fulfilled as we see, as we live today. But notice that Jesus stopped right here after the passage of the year to accept the Lord in mid-sentence. And he closed the book and gave it again to the minister, and he sat down. Again, sat down to teach. Everybody in the synagogue. And unlike here, where we're up in front, normally you'd be in the middle. There would be seats around the perimeter of the room, all facing the middle. And then Jesus sat down and began to speak, and he said, "This day, today, is this scripture fulfilled in your ears." And of course, that morning ended with them trying to take him out and throw him off a cliff and kill him. But notice that Jesus stopped in mid-sentence. He stopped between Zechariah 9:9 and Zechariah 14. So even though Zechariah 9:9 speaks of the first coming, Zechariah 9:10 speaks of the millennial reign, there is this period in between the two, between Christ's first coming as king and Christ's future coming to establish his kingdom. Now, Matthew references this, and notice all that Matthew references. We won't take the time to read it, but Matthew, as he talks about Jesus fulfilling this prophecy in detail, he points to Zechariah 9, verse 9, repeatedly. But he makes no reference to Zechariah 9, verse 10. Why do you think that is? Because that is yet to come. When the kingdom will come, when the King of Kings comes in power and glory. The first time, he came to a cross. His second coming, he's coming in power and glory to rule and reign. Verse 11, "As for thee also, by the blood of thy covenant, I have sent forth thy prisoners out of the pit wherein is no water." This is a picture of a dry cistern in Qumran. Of course, there is one long rainy season. The Bible calls it the early rains and the latter rains. Really, rainy season begins about October, ends about February. That's why those are very cheap periods of time to visit the Holy Land, because that is winter season. It's considered the rainy season. The rest of the year, it's very arid. Other than the Jordan River, you don't have access to a lot of fresh water, because on the west side, all you have is the Mediterranean, which is salt water. So during the rainy season, they had many cisterns in communities that were covered with plaster where they would gather and accumulate the rainwater to have it to access during the dry season. Obviously, these could also be used as prison cells, as Joseph was cast into something similar to this. When it was dry, when there was no longer any water in it, for those remaining months, you could use it as a place to hold a prisoner. Well, God is promising that all of the refugees of Israel shall be released. Doesn't matter whether from Egypt to Babylon, to the uttermost extent of the world, they will return to Israel. Turn you to the stronghold, or return you to Zion, you prisoners of hope. Even today do I declare that I will render double unto thee. Now, some commentators will say that that's referencing the firstborn having a double portion. I don't believe so. When God uses this in judgment, talks about, you know, we use the expression, I'll cover the check. What's that talking about? When the bill is laid down, you put your payment on top of it. Hence, it's covered. So in other words, what has been promised will be fulfilled. What is owed will be paid. So even today do I declare that I will render double unto thee. I believe that's the Jewish term, terminology that's being used there. When I have bent Judah for me, filled the bow with Ephraim. Now, that's subtle, but you see both southern kingdom, Judah, northern kingdom, Ephraim, united again. And raised up thy sons, O Zion, one Zion, Judah and Ephraim together, against thy sons, O Greece, and made thee as the sword of a mighty man. The blood of thy covenant, I believe that's talking about, there's some debate, but I believe what makes the most sense is that being the Abrahamic covenant. Remember in Genesis chapter 15, Abraham was concerned about God being able to keep his promises. Abraham was getting up in years, and he had no son. And God had promised that his seed would number as the stars in the sky and as the sand on the seashore. So Abraham said, Lord, if you need me to, I can legally adopt my chief of staff, Eliezer, and make him my son, then you'll be able to keep your promises. God said, thank you very much for the good thought, but I don't need your help. You're going to have a son. And then Abraham actually had the audacity. You talk about praying with boldness. Abraham had the audacity. Well, Lord, would you sign a contract to that effect? And that's what you hear the expression, cut a deal or cut a covenant. Abraham then took a sacrificial offering and cut it in half and put the pieces opposed to each other. And then enacting a covenant, the two covenant makers would walk between the pieces of that offering together, sealing the deal and signifying that this was a blood oath. And if either one of them broke the covenant, then that same thing is what should happen to them. But if you remember, Abraham got sleepy and he dozed off and he awakened semi-awake to see the Shekinah, the pillar of a fire and pillar of a cloud, alone walking through this animal. What does that mean? That means it's an unconditional promise. God made this promise to Abraham, and he is going to keep it. Not because Abraham's descendants are deservant, but because God's reputation is on the line. That's repeated throughout many of the Old Testament prophets. Ezekiel 36 and one passage in particular, where God says, I'm not doing this for your sake, but for my own name's sake. Why? Because I said I was going to do it, and I'm going to keep my word. So for thy covenant's sake, this is going to happen, and the Jews shall return from all over planet Earth. And again, recognize how remarkable this is. You hear me talk about this before. Ezekiel goes into great detail, beginning in about Ezekiel chapter 25 and going through chapter 35. God deals with judgment upon Gentiles, just like he is doing here. But there is no more Philistia, and there are no more Philistines. There's no more Ammonites. Ammon has been done away with. There's no more Ammonites. There are people that still live in a different country in that geographical area, but there's no Ammonites anymore. Israel had no place to call home for 2,000 years. But whereas the Edomites are done away with, the Ammonites are done away with, the Philistines are done away with, the Sidonians are done away with, as God destroyed their home and the people were then assimilated into other people groups, into other countries and other cultures, Israel, the Israelites or the Jews, always retained their identity. I believe that's one of the reasons God had those kosher laws. I think there was a number of reasons, but there are a lot of things that the Jews did that maintained that they not assimilate unto other cultures, that they stay distinct. And it's a miracle when you think about it. You know, how long would America have to be gone before they stopped referring to us as Americans? You know, I don't think, probably not more than 50 years or 100 years when the last of the Americans died off and there was a new people that occupied this particular geographical area. But there was no Israel for almost 2,000 years, but the Jews retained their identity. And then on May the 14th, 1948, you had David Ben-Gurion reading from the book of Ezekiel, and you saw the nation of Israel again reborn. And we see the constant flow as Jews are making Aliyah, returning to the promised land. There's now some 8 million people living in Israel, 7 million Jews, about 1 million Arabs. You know, there's still that many living in other parts of the world. But after the tribulation, God will draw them, continue to draw them back, the Scripture says, and I've got no reason to believe otherwise. Verse 14, and the Lord shall be seen over them, and His arrows shall go forth as the lightning, and the Lord shall blow the trumpet, and shall go with whirlwinds of the south. That trumpet is shofar. If you are keeping up with your through-the-year Bible reading, we are reading about Saul this week, where Saul blew the shofar, which was the call to arms for the militia to show up to defend the country. Well, here's God blowing the shofar, calling the assembly, and should go forth with whirlwinds. Now, we know what a whirlwind is. We have them on a grand scale here in Oklahoma. We call them tornadoes. But this is indicative of God's judgment. God's going to sound the alarm. He's going to send judgment. And the Lord of hosts, Jehovah Sabaoth, the Lord of armies, shall defend Israel, and they shall devour and subdue with sling stones, and they shall drink and make a noise as though they were drunken. This be the invading armies. They shall fill like bowls, like the bowls of blood that were used by the priests in the temple sacrifice and at the corners of the altars. And the Lord shall save them in that day as the flock of His people. He is the good shepherd. And they shall be as stones of a crown lifted up as an ensign upon His land. And how great is His goodness, and how great is His beauty. Corn shall make the young man cheerful, and new wine the maid. So again, a reference to the time of plenty and provision in the kingdom age. So that Zechariah 9. Over the next couple of weeks, of course next week we're going to take a little detour. We're going to talk about the events of the Passion Week. But we are going to see the actual redemption price, or the purchase price, that the Jews sold out their good shepherd for. 30 pieces of silver, of course, Judas Iscariot. We're going to see the events that lead up to what we call the Battle of Armageddon. We're going to see that the Messiah is going to show up, and the Jews will celebrate, and then they're going to say, "Where did you get the nail prints in your hands?" And He'll say, "I got them in the house of my friends." And then there, as they have been delivered at Armageddon, when victory is assured and the Messiah is there, then it's going to dawn on them why they've endured the last 2,000 years of suffering. The Bible goes into great detail about their celebratory joy of the arrival of the Messiah, but at the same time, there will be great mourning among the people individually as they will lament what they did 2,000 years ago in rejecting their Messiah when He came the first time. So the next few chapters are very exciting. I hope that you've enjoyed this whole study. Again, the book of Zechariah is basically designed into about three parts. You got the first six chapters. Then you've got chapters 7 and 8, which are what we covered last week. with the delegation coming down from Bethel, and then from chapter 9 forward, we see messianic promises of the kingdom and the kingdom age, both the first coming, Zechariah 9:9, and the second coming in Zechariah 14. So exciting stuff, and from all this, we derive much of what you'll read about, you'll study when you get to the book of Revelation. All right, well, we'll call her a night. We'll close in a word of prayer for our Bible study, and then we'll get into our actual time of prayer requests. So thank you all for always being such a great, attentive group to speak to, preach to, and teach.